Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. on Monday, April 29, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phone. Present today, we have Senator Tobin, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 66, Controlled Substances, Homicide Crimes, Sentencing, sponsored by the House Rules by request of the governor. Before the committee is a proposed committee substitute. I want to note that we have here for questions Director Angie Kemp and Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law, Nancy Mead from the court system, Captain Cornelia Sims, Lieutenant Robert French, and Lisa Purinton from the Department of Public Safety. And what I would, and I note that Senator Kaufman has joined us at 1:31. We could present a committee substitute, but my suggestion, because the Department of Law has a fairly extensive presentation about House Bill 66, rather than have a short summary, we let them make their presentation, and then we'll take up a motion to adopt the committee substitute after their presentation. Unless somebody objects to that procedure, if the department wants to come up, then tell us about House Bill 66.
Thank you. For the record, Director Kemp, Angie Kemp, I hadn't intended on doing a significant presentation again to the committee. I'm happy to certainly answer any questions that the committee has. I can follow up on any of the provisions that were offered in the CS. I just want to say thank you to the committee and the committee chair for working with the Department of Law and helping to frame the CS in the way that it has been framed today.
I know that the committee substitute has much of House Bill 66, also includes provisions from House Bill 265, provisions from Senate Bill 53, and provisions from Senate Bill 65. Can you give us a little bit of comment as to those four different bills that are built into this committee substitute?
Absolutely. As Chair Klayman mentioned, there are several pieces of or different parts of legislation that have been consolidated into the CS. The first that I'll focus on is the grand jury provision related to allowing for summaries of witnesses' statements to be presented. This was something that was originally a part of HB 67 and has been incorporated into the CS today. As the senators know, this was certainly an important aspect of the legislation for the Department of Law. It really truly is designed to help victims of crime in order to avoid re-traumatizing those individuals. I know that this last year we had some conversation about a similar provision that was offered, and I gave examples of why this is important to the Department of Law. And why we believe it's important for victims' rights, and as I think Senator Klayman had offered, the constitutional provisions that specifically protect victims of crime. This, as folks may recall, allows again for a witness to come in and summarize admissible evidence. This provision in the CS acknowledges that the rules of hearsay do not apply at grand jury proceedings, and mirrors us with, in part, the federal government and how their rules of procedure apply. One other fact to note about the CS and the language that was incorporated is Alaska still will be somewhat of an outlier because we're not going as far as, for example, the federal government does in their rules of procedure. They declare that, for instance, the rules of evidence just simply don't apply. Folks may perceive from this piece of legislation, the language is admissible evidence and also indicates separately that the hearsay rules are inapplicable to the two grand jury proceedings. That's a more narrow tailoring of the rules of procedure than, for instance, our federal partners. It is not also outside or is not inconsistent with other states in the way that they do business. Again, Alaska is an outlier as it stands right now. but there are numerous other states that follow a similar path, including, for instance, Alabama, Maine, Delaware, Kentucky, Mississippi, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, South Carolina, and the list goes on. So that's one aspect of the legislation that is incorporated into the CS. I don't know if at this point you want me to just pause and let folks ask any questions that they might have of this particular.
If you want to give a couple of comments, first about House Bill 265, the child sexual abuse material and the name change, if you could provide a couple of comments on that. And I note Senator Geisel joined us at 1:35. If you want to add a few comments on that, I'll ask you questions about the three things that are added.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you again, Chair Clayman. So as it relates to what I'll describe loosely as the name change, this is really designed to represent, I think, what is the graphic memorialization of something more than simply pornography. The name change has somewhat important meaning to myself as a former prosecutor who prosecuted child pornography and child distribution cases. And there are a few things I can tell you from my experience that stick with you and have a more resonating impact on us as prosecutors than observing child pornography. It truly is the memorialization of torture and quite honestly, what I assume is aspects of these children's lives that few can appreciate. And so to rename it and call it what it truly is, I think is an important step to acknowledging that it's more than simply pornography. It is the memorialization of these children's as torture.
I'd note that the bill also includes Senate Bill 53 involving involuntary commitment and incompetency to proceed. That's an area that the Senate has passed the legislation. So I think we're familiar with Senate Bill 53. Do you want to add anything about House Bill 66? I know we've presented on it before, but as we look at the committee substitute.
You bet. And again, what I'll say about House Bill 66 is that it is designed to recognize what is a public health crisis in the state of Alaska right now. Committee members could look at the Alaska Public Health Report as of September of 2023 and know with certainty that we are in a crisis. From 2018 to 2022, there was a marked increase in the number of overdose deaths involving both fentanyl and methamphetamines to the tune of 150%. Quite incredible numbers, increases in overdose deaths. And those are just the deaths that are in fact deaths. As the committee members know, substances or kits that are designed to help individuals recover from an overdose are readily available and much more accessible than they were 2, 5, 10 years ago. So these are deaths as a result of these overdoses. So these aspects of HB 66 are designed to address that public health crisis and hopefully create some additional deterrence for these types of offenses, and recognize that, as I said, we have a crisis on our hands, and it seems to be getting worse.
Right. Questions from committee members with regard to the committee substitute? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I anticipate that I'll have many questions, as these are many different bills, and I just want to make sure that I've wrapped my brain around them. And I'm particularly thinking of House Bill 66. And so I'm looking particularly at the fiscal note, as I see that it's a zero fiscal note from the Department of Corrections. And I think there's some recent data that was just released about the number of overdoses that come from people who are exiting Department of Corrections. And so I'm curious as to why it's a zero fiscal note. Is there going to be no treatment in Department of Corrections for folks who are now being incarcerated based on this change to the statute? Is there going to be no services? Are you not anticipating there to be an increase of folks who are being incarcerated due to this change in the statute? I'm just hopeful that you can unpack why is it a zero fiscal note.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Tobin. Being with the Department of Law, I would hesitate to offer insight on Department of Corrections fiscal note and why it's a zero fiscal note. I don't know if we have any other folks from Department of Corrections on the line today. I can only tell you for Department of Law's fiscal note that while we believe there would be some increase in litigation surrounding these additional provisions, we think that we can absorb those additional work without requiring additional positions as it pertains to HB 66.
And I'd note we're not moving the bill today, so that we can certainly get Department of Corrections here at the next hearing on this bill to answer those questions. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess maybe that comes to my next question is there's quite a bit of research, particularly I'm thinking of a 2021 meta-analysis of 116 studies on recidivism, and they show that this kind of instances of reincarceration doesn't actually deter the crime. So I'm curious just from your perspective of how this shift in HB 66 is going to stop this crisis, is going to actually prevent this crisis from happening, because the data doesn't support that argument.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Tobin. I would certainly love to review the research that you have reviewed and cite today. I think that there's a whole body of research out there about these issues, and they're complicated, and I respect that. One thing about the way that, and I'm sure that you folks know, is the way that criminal law works is it allows for inherent deterrence. And part of, for instance, the sentencing criteria that we as prosecutors look to include, for instance, deterrence of the individual, and maybe more important to your point, Senator Tobin, deterrence of the community itself. This is absolutely something when we start talking about fentanyl and distributing fentanyl that speaks to some of those or should speak to some of those sentencing criteria. And while incarceration alone is never going to be the solution to all of our problems, it, I think, is a part of encouraging individuals to help through the rehabilitation process. I realize that may sound naive and maybe silly in context, but it does, in fact, work itself out. For example, you resolve a misconduct involving controlled substance case, and you're always, with very few exceptions, I'll say, going to be seeking treatment in some capacity. And indicating that person should also, as part of their sentence, take rehabilitative steps or at least have those things made available to them. So it isn't just incarceration, though these increases do, I think, in some aspects respect that is a part of the stick. But there are a number of ways that these cases are resolved in order to meet the ends that you're talking about and the importance of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do look forward to hearing from the Department of Corrections because I heard again substance treatment and looking at the fiscal notes, that's not included, and just very concerned that if the goal is to get people to rehabilitate, then we've got to provide those services while they're in our care.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, the residential substance abuse treatment program within corrections is available in the last 6 months of your sentence. It doesn't matter if that's 7 years or 17 years. There really isn't a material difference on the sentencing side with regard to the actual likelihood of getting people off of the drugs that are causing these problems, whether we pass these provisions or not. One of the things we talked about when a comparable bill was heard here on the Senate side was the difficulty of writing the statutes in such a way that they are targeted toward the drug dealers and importers who have been the focus of the department's conversation, the people bringing in fentanyl, people manufacturing or bringing in methamphetamine and selling it. And differentiating those people from the fellow user and the scenario we heard from parents about the two people who used together and one of them ended up dead. When we look at what the other body did with House Bill 66, the bill in front of us, did they do anything to address that difficult legal drafting challenge?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Keel, not that I recall. I respect your point. It is a challenge in trying to carve out those maybe differences factually, and will always be something, I think, that regardless of whether it's codified in statute, that would be taken into consideration in how that case is ultimately handled. And by handled, I mean the broad discretion that prosecutors are inherently charged with as part of their normal or daily dealings. So not that I recall.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. Senator Giesel.
Sure. You know, I know there's a question about repeated incarceration, but actually those are steps in rehabilitation because the person does go through withdrawal, right, and is put into another, however short, treatment. You know, buprenorphine is an expensive medication that needs to be continued after release. And that, I don't know what headway we've made in doing that, because it is expensive. I don't know if Medicaid is covering it for these folks. But there are tools, not just counseling, but actual treatment that can be very effective. Granted, it takes a year or even two on buprenorphine to actually uncloud the mind. But I would push back on the concept that reincarceration is not helpful. Just a comment.
Doesn't require a response. We do have, there's a printed summary of changes. If anyone on the committee would like us to present that, we certainly can, although it's a fairly short summary of changes. Is there an interest from anyone in the committee to hear a verbal presentation of the summary of changes? Is the written version enough? Don't see any requests. So, Senator Keel, if I could have a motion with regard to the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Judiciary adopt as our working document Senate CS for House Bill number 66 Judiciary, which is version 33GH1482/Y as in Yakutat.
Hearing and seeing no objection, we will adopt the Y version as our committee substitute. And are there further questions about this piece of legislation before we go on to our next presentation today? Hearing and seeing none. Thank you very much for coming today. Next on our list, and I would note briefly with regard to staying on House Bill 66, if you have amendments that you'd like to propose, we'll set a deadline for amendments to House Bill 66 for noon on Wednesday. I'm aware of this has a finance referral after this committee, and we're not in the first month of session, and so the deadline on Wednesday would allow us to take up House Bill 66 again on Thursday evening. All right. The last item on our agenda is a presentation from the Department of Public Safety on their health and wellness program. Here to present is Lieutenant Kid Chan in person, and Lieutenant Michael Henry is online. Lieutenant Chan, if you would please come forward, join us in the front. And Lieutenant Henry, since you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and often difficult to hear what you're saying. And if you want to proceed with it, we're going to take a brief at ease because we got to put the screen on. You can stay seated, okay. Lieutenant. We're going to take a brief at ease while we get the projector going. Lieutenant Chan, thank you for your patience while we got the screen running. If you want to proceed.
Good afternoon, and for the record, to the chair and Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Lieutenant Chan. I'm with the Alaska State Troopers. Thank you for having me today to provide a presentation on our wellness program and also what we're training our troopers in the field to prepare them to respond to subjects who are going through mental health crisis, including people who are suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia. So with that said, I would like to start with just to provide you guys with a brief wellness program background. Back in 2013, we started a peer support group with the Department of Public Safety, where we have members who are reactive in providing critical incident stress debriefs when troopers are exposed to critical incidents. Over the course of the last 10 years, the program has made significant changes from being reactive to actually being proactive. So in the past 4 years, at least, our program, the peer support program, has grown to include four teams of five members per team of commissioned troopers, and to also spousal teams to respond to help handle some of the stressors that our family members are exposed to, and also a chaplain program. So the peer support program has grown tremendously, especially under the direction of Commissioner Cockrell for the past few years. And we're more proactive now in reaching out and making sure that our members, I'm not just talking about commissioned troopers, but also civilian members of DPS and other law enforcement agencies, where we're being requested to provide critical incident stress debriefs for and DOC, Department of Corrections, for Department of Natural Resources, for the Division of Forestry, Fire EMS. And so we are, the program has just grown a lot, and we're super busy with taking care of not just people within DPS, but also other agencies as well.
I think you might be one slide behind now. I think you're on slide three.
Did I move too fast? Anyways.
That's okay. I just was looking at the slide ahead. And
said, yeah, I just started talking. To the chair, in 2022, there's about 1,000 peer support contacts that we made. And in 2023 itself, we have over 1,900 contacts. And this year is no different. We have seen a significant shift in our wellness culture. In the past, you know, it's all about stigma. No one really wants to come forward when it comes to seeking help and asking for assistance. However, because there's a shift in culture and we have established a trust in within our wellness program, that troopers are now coming forward, civilian employees are coming forward looking for resources and looking for help. So we really embrace the proactive approach. I think has really made a big difference in our wellness program. Moving on to the next slide. All of our peer members have to attend a five-day certification course, and that's through the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. And it's a standardized course where our peer members now have the tools and the knowledge and the skills to be able to provide the services that our members need when it comes to stress and when it comes to cumulative trauma that they've been exposed to over the course of their career, so that they're better equipped and they can help them because they've experienced it themselves too. We are also sending our troopers to an advanced ICISF course, which is the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation certification course. And moving on this year, and hopefully next year, starting next year actually, we're going to start sending our peer members to a new curriculum, a new peer support certification course that is put together by the Fraternal Order of Police in the lower 48 in conjunction with the Department of Justice and also the community-oriented program services. So this is a new nationally accredited peer support program that we're going to make sure that our troopers get trained in it. Just so getting more information, gaining more knowledge and skills so that they can be better prepared to help our peers. within the department and also other agencies as well. Moving on to the next slide here, I have a brief overview of the wellness app that we started using about 2 years ago, which is the Cortical Shield wellness app. It's a great resource because the app has everything in your fingertips and is completely anonymous. In other words, it's strictly confidential. The only thing that we do track in the app is the number of users who are signing on to the app itself. There's a wealth of resources in there, and to this date, we have about 300 users, and it's not just limited to the Department of Public Safety, but also other law enforcement agencies within the state and fire EMS at the same time. I included 90% of officers say that cultural stigma creates a barrier to getting help for the emotional and behavioral issues, and that is a national standard. But at the same time, a few years ago, before we started this culture this wellness program, we actually conducted a survey within DPS. And the survey itself was also very telling as far as why folks are not coming forward to ask for assistance, because there's the stigma. If I come forward, I may appear to be weak. I may appear to be having a lot of stress that I'm afraid that the department is going to come after me. However, through the cultural shift in the past few years, we have established that trust of confidentiality, and we have also established that, hey, it's okay to not be okay. In other words, come out, come forward, talk to us, and we'll look for resources and we'll take care of you guys. So that's the shift. It's a huge shift, like I said earlier, and I think it's really doing us a lot of we have taken a lot of positive steps, and it's a great resource. The app is a great resource, not just for the presently commissioned troops, but also for their family, for the spouses, for retired troopers, as well as the VPSOs and other employees within the state. So lots of positive steps moving forward. And I got to say that I've been very excited. This past few weeks, we finally hired our first clinician within DPS. So for the first time in the history of Department of Public Safety, we have a clinician. And she came to us from DOC with 8 years of experience. Some of her duties entails, you know, identifying and enhancing existing wellness resources, providing the services, and just going out there meeting our folks and establishing again the trust and the confidentiality. And the clinician is going to be doing ride-alongs with the troopers in the field just to see what some of the stressors and the trauma that our troopers may be exposed to, and also help with that and better providing training and education for our wellness program. To this date, within the first 5-6 weeks of her employment, she has had at least 12 official clinical sessions already, and a dozen more of unofficial. And then when I say unofficial sessions, that includes a meeting or when she visits different posts where she would have a contact. The unofficial session takes about half an hour or so. So it becomes kind of an unofficial session. It's not something that she actually scheduled, but more or less a meeting with the troopers at the post, strike up a conversation, and then it just gets to be at least half an hour or so. She has had over 200 contacts just within our department. She has attended some training with us. She's immersing herself into our culture as far as law enforcement culture is concerned. So she'll be moving forward. She'll be attending a lot more training nationwide so that she can network and also learn more about what other agencies are doing within law enforcement and clinician. Next, we have the crisis intervention team. So this is something that DPS has supported the Metsu CIT coalition and its certification to CIT International. We were first involved in 2015, and it was formed to develop first responder partnerships, provide training, explore additional solutions for individuals in crisis with mental illness or addiction disorders. Really, the mission of CIT is that, hey, when someone is going through mental health crisis, and it could be a personality disorder, it could be PTSD, it could be substance abuse, sending them to jail may not solve the problem, may not be the first thing that we should do. So with CIT form, what we're trying to do is that providing services instead of just say, all right, this person committed such and such crime, he's going straight into incarceration, right? Instead of that, there are now in a system within itself, there are behavioral health services that is meant for to help the folks who are suicidal, who are just going through a lot of challenges in mental health crisis. So in 2017, in partnership with the Metsu Health Foundation, we had our first CIT course. It is a 40-hour course, and it helps us with the interactions with the members of the community who are experiencing a mental health crisis. We also deliver an 8-hour course to our troopers, which is known as the Mental Health First Aid. That is to help our troopers identify some of the issues that or challenges that we're facing. If our coworkers are suicidal, if our coworkers is resorting to substance abuse, that's going to help us identify those challenges where we can now provide services and get them help or provide intervention for that matter so that they can get help. Moving forward, we talk about the 40-hour training program with law enforcement. We want to make sure that family members learn about our experiences. A big portion of it with the CIT now is about verbal de-escalation. We train our troopers in verbal de-escalation, not just at the academy level, but also during the field training program and during in-service. Because verbal de-escalation is all about professional police communication. And that's going to help us in de-escalating the situation where we don't have to use force and we can resolve the situation in a peaceful manner. So consumer and family involvement in steering advisory committees and coordinating training sessions. It is a community collaboration between mental health providers, law enforcement officers, family and consumer advocates. During the 40-hour program itself, there is actually at least about 8 to 12 hours where we have scenario-based training. So there's role-playing during the training, and it's not just a PowerPoint presentation. There's a site visit where we visit certain sites, which includes the women's shelter, rehab places, but we also have role-playing when it comes to de-escalation. We want to make sure that our, not just troopers, but including fire EMS and other law enforcement agencies are trained in de-escalation when we're dealing with mental health crisis people. Part of the program is also to deter... Sorry. Senator
Geese. Yeah, I'm trying to reconcile this with the crisis now mm-hmm. system that many communities are using. Is this just the state trooper version of it?
So through the chair, Senator Geese, it's not just the state troopers. Actually, a lot of different agencies are using it. So we have it in Fairbanks with Fairbanks Police Department. We have it over in the Metsu area with Wasilla Police Department. Ketchikan is starting off next year, kicking it off next year. Juneau has a program itself also. So it's not just the Alaska State Troopers. It is a statewide effort in setting up this mobile crisis teams so that we can help the community who are suffering from mental health crisis.
Okay, not exactly an answer, but that's okay. It's all right. It's fine.
I mean, I
get it.
Well, I think
this seems, Mr. Chairman, it seems duplicative to me of the crisis now, which communities are doing, where a clinician responds to the crisis. I'm trying to figure out how this meshes together, and if we aren't doing two things separately.
So, through the chair, this is actually under the same umbrella as CIT. So the mobile crisis now is actually under the umbrella of crisis intervention teams. So crisis intervention team is a national program. And through CIT itself, that's how they set up the mobile crisis now programs, where clinicians are involved, fire EMS are involved. They are trained in recognizing substance abuse, and they are also trained in behavioral mental health services. Does that answer your question a bit better?
Thank you.
And just a follow-up. So Anchorage, when you were listing communities doing it, so Anchorage has some mobile crisis teams that have some non-police officers on the mobile teams. Is that following some of the same national structures?
To the chair, yes, that is correct. It's the same national structure program, and it's not just Anchorage Police that has non-commissioned officers who are part of the mobile crisis now. Actually, every single team has either a behavioral mental health clinician or a fire EMS person who is trained in CIT stuff.
I don't see any further, and I figured if we had questions, we could interrupt you. So,
absolutely.
Okay, go ahead and proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Through the chair, just a mental health training overview. We recognize the symptoms and identify strategies to respond to a person in crisis while obtaining a voluntary cooperation in maintaining officer safety. So a lot of it has to do with de-escalation. You know, we exercise extra care when we are responding to patients who are going through mental health crisis, patients who are having dementia and Alzheimer's symptoms. We teach our troopers about available resources for persons in crisis, and we understand the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Title 47, which is handling folks with a mental health crisis and looking for services for them, other than just taking them to jail for the Title 47 hold. There are so many different type of mental health conditions out there. In addition, there's also behavioral health concerns such as suicide. We do respond to a lot of suicide calls as it's very common, unfortunately, but those are some of the type of trainings that we're providing the troopers at the academy, in the field, during in-service. And also, in addition to that, there's also training, additional training per detachment. For example, A detachment has an 8-hour training on their standard operating procedures on how to respond to mental health services. And with that said, I would like to call upon Lieutenant Henry so that he can provide you guys with a brief overview of what the training encompasses.
Lieutenant Henry.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Lieutenant Michael Henry with the State Troopers. I'm in Saldana. Can you hear me okay on the phone?
Yes, thank you.
All right. I'm just going to, I think, insert a little bit of information particular for our area and some of the other areas and address a little bit some of the questions that I heard voiced. As far as the mobile crisis response teams, I've heard them called different things in different locations, but the concept is as was spoken about here just a minute ago, the concept of kind of a multidisciplinary team where you have some sort of mental health professional that's actually could respond to the scene of a mental health crisis incident as it's happening. It sounds like that the committee is aware, that exists in some places, but of course it doesn't exist in all places. So for example, in my location on the Kenai Peninsula, we don't have any sort of mobile crisis response team. Basically, the response team is law enforcement and emergency medical services because there's no responding mental health component here. And that's true for a lot of places in the state, but they are growing in number. The other thing that we don't have here in the Kenai Peninsula is any sort of crisis, like mental health crisis stabilization centers. Those, as I'm sure you guys are aware, exist in some places in the state, but not all places. So, for example, in the Kenai Peninsula, as in other places, our only options to physically bring someone to a place to get help is the primary care hospital, the emergency room, both in Homer, Seward, and Soldotna are the communities where we have hospitals. Otherwise, if people have committed criminal offenses, then they'll go to the jail. But otherwise, if we're detaining a person for simply a mental health reason where we believe they need emergency detention for like a mental health evaluation, then they're going to the hospital. So the recent training that we're implementing is to try to bridge the gap of getting consistent as to how we're responding to these incidents with the limited resources that we have in our area, and trying to follow federal court guidelines as well as state laws, and implementing a policy where we can increase our consistency of how we're dealing with these and increase our consistent expectations with the partnering agencies like the EMS and local police departments. So that's basically the concept of the training that we've just put on. This is very new for us. We just implemented the training in April and just completed the main bulk. We've trained all our troopers on this new policy. But of course, like I said, it doesn't involve a mobile crisis response team because we don't have any responding mental health professionals in our area that can actually respond to a scene. And that's it for my basic presentation, and I can take any questions anyone has.
I don't see any questions from the committee. I think I've just back
to the chair. This is Lieutenant Chan here. So continuing on with the select presentation, we started training our troopers at academy level and during in-service with Alzheimer's and dementia training. We want to make sure that they have some knowledge, understanding what the Alzheimer's disease is and ways to positive interact with successful outcomes. We understand that there are at least 50% of dementia cases are Alzheimer's. With half of the dementia cases suffering from Alzheimer's, we need as troopers a strong base of awareness and understanding to effectively handle the situation involving persons who are going through an Alzheimer's disease. We familiarize with the unique aspect of Alzheimer's disease and learn the best way to recognize, communicate, and respond to people with AD. Proper training and knowledge will encourage successful interactions and outcomes. And moving on to slide 11, things that we can do.
Just one question. So the training on Alzheimer's and dementia is both in service training after their commission, but it's now part of the Trooper Academy as well.
Yes, it is.
Okay, when did it start? When did it become part of Trooper Academy?
It's been at least 5 years that I know of, because what happened was that in the past, we only have a mental health first aid class, which is the 8-hour course. But we found that it's very critical for our recruits to understand that some of the challenges that they'll be facing, which is responding to mental health crisis people. So we included portion of training that is related to CIT, responding to mental health crisis, and also Alzheimer's and dementia training. So it's a 12-hour course at the academy, and which in addition to that, they have scenarios also, scenario-based training at the academy.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question on slide number 10 is, I see the bullet point that 50% of dementia cases are Alzheimer's. Out of all of the cases that the Alaska State Troopers deal with, how many of those are dementia cases?
To the chair and Senator Tobin, I don't actually have the information per se, because it's I'm not in the field right now. I create training, but I can do some research and follow up with the answer.
Thank you.
Thank you. To the chair, we're going to continue on with slide number 11. So talking about things that we can do to assist, it's a lot about communication when it comes to our work. It's all about professional police communication. In this case, we train our troopers, make sure that they empathize with folks who are suffering from disease so that they can communicate a little bit slower. We ask questions, we clarify the questions, and we ask for specifics. We do come across a lot of calls from dispatch where they would say, so-and-so who is suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's has walked away from their house or from an assisted living place. And so when we launch a assist and rescue type, when we try to find the person, once we come upon the person, everything slows down. We want to make sure that we communicate clearly with the subjects and help them find where they needed to go, and also look for identifications and be patient and understanding. And I think that's very important when it comes to training, is that we train our troopers to be better listeners. It's not easy to do that sometimes because they're going from one call to the next call. But we do reinforce that, hey, being good listeners, you can actually absorb a lot of, get a lot of information. And as a result, your response is going to be so much better. So we also inform our troopers about the sound downing effect, what they call it, sound downers. When an individual becomes disoriented and confused in the evening after being coherent during the early part of the day. So we warn our troopers about those, some of the symptoms that we're looking at. Some of the calls that we have received includes items that are being stolen, and we may choose to treat those as a non-criminal case rather than we should actually get them help. We talk to their family members. Unfortunately, a lot of times when it comes to Alzheimer's and dementia, we do have repeat people calls from the same families. So troopers are aware of some of those families that we respond to statewide, and every single area has those families who have a family member who is experiencing dementia symptoms or who has Alzheimer's disease. One other thing that we do when it comes time to respond to Alzheimer's and dementia calls is that we make sure to notify fire EMS. We want to make sure that we stage the EMS for the call. So we'll go up and make contact, but EMS is always either at the end of the driveway or just around the corner, just in case if we need them, because we want to make sure that we get them the resources and the help that's needed. So again, this slide number 12 talks about some of the training that we provide to we remind our troopers about. Family may have moved some things for the person's own protection. Items that would be considered a routine activity, such as cooking, but are now unable to be done safely, so pots and pans and knives are removed. Again, following slide number 13, we're still talking about we're training our troopers. These are some of the information that we share with our troops, is that individuals with dementia may not know where they are. They're confused. There is a diminished capacity when it comes to knowing what is going on, and they may not be dressed appropriately, especially for Alaska, given that our inclement weather and our long winter months. They misplace things, lose the ability to retrace steps, and have decreased or poor judgment. We don't challenge the person's reality, so this is where empathy comes into play. We listen to what the person has to say, and we don't challenge them. We work with the individuals through de-escalation. That's what we do. We try to empathize with them and then listen to what do they say. We listen to the family members. It's a little bit more difficult if a crime of domestic violence is involved. That's the time where we determine whether a crime has occurred or not. However, if we choose not to arrest, we would call the DA's office to let them know what we have to make sure that we get permission not to arrest, but instead to get this person help or services. We instruct our officers to slow down and help those who need it. We try to talk to the individuals as if they are our loved ones. So it takes a lot of patience on our troopers' part to really talk to them in a very calm manner. We use our voice inflection very with care so that we don't upset the person and we take care of them. So we exercise more duty to care. Again, Alzheimer's patients and subjects with dementia are usually scared due to the confusion. The situation itself sometimes can be chaotic, especially when domestic violence is involved. So we make sure that we train our troopers to calm and diffuse the situation as best we can with de-escalation techniques. Sometimes, again, being good listeners, showing empathy, paraphrasing what's been said by the subjects always helps. We address their basic needs, and we would want to treat them the way we want to be treated. And I think that extends to just our normal day professional police communication, is that we treat people with respect no matter who they are. We're not abrupt, and we don't talk to make them feel, we want to make sure that they feel more comfortable instead of making things worse. That's what we train our troopers to do when it comes to responding to Alzheimer's and dementia. Taking them into custody always is going to be best accomplished through verbal de-escalation, if it's all possible, without obviously compromising officer safety. With that said, to the chair and the Senate Judiciary Committee, that concludes my presentation. If there are any questions, myself and Lieutenant Henry is here to answer.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just curious to mention that, you know, the percentage of dementia cases that are Alzheimer's, is there a difference in the way that you would handle different forms of dementia as far as a response?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, as far as how we handled it, there's actually not a difference because they shared the similar symptoms as far as diminished capacity is concerned, right? So we would always exercise due care when it comes to handling Alzheimer's patients and people who are suffering from dementia symptoms.
Thank you.
So we've had some different constituents in the Capitol this year asking questions about law enforcement training on Alzheimer's and dementia. Is the program one that's kind of, you've got it figured out and it doesn't change, or is this something you're continuing to work on developing and improving the training that you provide to troopers?
To the chair, when it comes to training, we're always working on improving our training program, because as we dive into the subject, we start gathering more and more information. And with that said, training evolves over time, because we want to make sure that the training that we provide to the troopers is the most current and the best practice.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see any other questions. So I want to thank you very much for coming and presenting, and thanks to the department. That's been an area that we've been having questions, both in terms of the general trooper mental health and doing well on the job, as well as some of the folks that you all have regular contact with. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senators.
We're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting, as I noted on the floor today, our Tuesday meeting is canceled, but our next meeting is Wednesday, May 1st at 1:30 p.m. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:23 p.m.